As I prayed, I really do want that to be kind of the goal of what we're doing as we're walking through this law. It's not that we just academically understand every different law and what all of it meant, but that we would better understand how impossible it is to keep the law in every point. And as we recall James chapter 2, which says, if you keep the whole law but you offend in one point, you're guilty of the whole thing. So I want us to recognize as we walk through these laws, that's why we're taking some of the time we're taking as we go through these individually, thinking about maybe speeding up just a little bit. But as we walk through these individually, that's why we're doing it, is just to see how intricate the law was and how detailed it was and how that made it really impossible to keep, which was always the plan. The plan was always that the law would be impossible to keep and drive people to recognize their need for someone to keep it for them. And that is exactly what Galatians tells us about the law with regard to its position. There in Galatians, it makes it real clear, there's no flesh ever justified by keeping the law. But the justification comes in the one who kept the law perfectly, and his perfect keeping the law is then imputed to us on our behalf. So I think that's something to encourage us. But in all that, what I find very interesting is no place does it say that because a future person is going to keep it for you, just don't try. I don't see that anywhere. I think there's still a requirement or a call to holiness, a call to live the way God wants us to live in response to him and who he is. So that's kind of my hope that we'll get as we walk through the law. So we are now in chapter 22. I feel bad. Kenny's parents are here this morning, and they were here probably, 3 or 4 months ago, and we've gained one chapter since they've been gone. So you didn't miss much, guys. Just welcome back, by the way. So you missed like one verse. So we're in chapter 22 now, and we're walking through now the laws concerning restitution. And those are neighbor-to-neighbor laws. Again, this section mostly is neighbor to neighbor, love your neighbor as yourself. How do you do that? How do those last six commandments really flesh out in daily life in Israel? That's what this is, and it's really taking so many different kinds of situations and making very clear here's what this law means regarding those situations. So it's not left for interpretation. It's not left for someone else to try to interpret. God makes it really clear, here's what I mean by what I say. So that's what's going on here. And so we're in the middle of this section called, I call it the laws concerning restitution. That's paying back for things that you either misuse or broken or whatever. And it really has to do with I think, just treating, again, loving your neighbor as yourself. As you walk through, you'll just see that kind of it's what's driving is this loving your neighbor as yourself. So we'll look at 22 verse 1 first. It says, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. So this law is actually in two bits. There's this bit here, and there's a bit in verse 4, I believe it is. Because you get them, if the man steals the ox and he kills it, he has to pay back 5 oxes for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. Some people feel like that's kind of what Zacchaeus is doing when he tells Jesus as Jesus comes to his house, he says, "I'll repay 4 times what I've stolen." Folks think he's referring back to this. Okay, so that's sheep, but remember, there's a difference here. There's 5 oxen for an ox, or 4 sheep for a sheep. I have no clue why the difference. Why I cannot answer the question why. So don't even ask me. Well, why are oxen worth more than a sheep? And maybe that's the deal. Maybe an ox is not just for food or just for clothing or just for sacrifice. An ox is a farm implement. An ox wasn't, we don't use oxen the way they used oxen in those days. An oxen was the combine, it was the plow, it was the tractor, it was the chief implement used to make your farm go was your ox. And so if someone stole your ox and killed it, that was not just affecting one part of your life, it really was affecting every part of your life. And remember, we're in an agrarian society now. We're not in an industrialized society. So they're not going to an office and doing work in an office and coming home and petting their ox. That's not what's going on here. That ox is used for their livelihood. And so that's potentially why the ox is worth five to one and the sheep are worth 4 to 1. That's potentially. But that's strictly potentially. I don't have any other indication as to why that is. But if you go to verse 4, the last part of this whole situation there, it says, if the stolen beast is found alive in its possession, whether it's an ox, a donkey, or a sheep, then he just pays double. So if you steal the ox and the person finds you with the ox, then you pay back double the ox and double the donkey and double the sheep. That's a level fine all the way across. Why? Well, because the person's getting their ox, sheep, donkey back. And so you're not taking away the ability for them to farm or to do the thing that they're doing. So I think that's what's going on. So remember, the first chapter one is if it dies or if it's killed or if it's sold, so the thief no longer has it. Verse four is if the ox is found in his possession, then he pays back double the ox, and double the sheep and double the donkey. Those are the two. That's if they're still alive and still in his possession. So that's the stolen beast. And remember, we've already looked at some of the stealing and the redemption, the ransom that may have been a part of that as well. So that's the stealing the ox. In the middle of that, though, we have, I think, something that is somewhat important and something that we have had issues in our own nation recently regarding this kind of a law, this kind of a situation. So I'll just read it. It says, verse 2, if a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. There will be blood guilt. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So here's the deal. If someone breaks into your house at night to steal, and you kill that person at night, then you're justified, and that's a justified killing. There's no blood guilt. When the law says there's no blood guilt, it means you're not held responsible. There's no blood guilt. There's no ransom that needs to be paid. There's nothing that needs to happen. So you have, in the law of Moses, you have the ability to defend your home and defend your possessions by taking another life. I don't like using that word right. You have the justification to do that. It is a justified killing where there's no guilt on you for having done that. Unless it's daytime. If it's daytime, you cannot kill that thief. It's not justified. If you kill the thief at daytime, then you are guilty of blood guilt. You're guilty of murder at that point. When he says guilt, there is blood guilt, that means you are guilty of murder for killing the thief in your house in the daytime. That's what it means if the sun has risen on him. I was curious on this one. I was curious on this one because, we have what are called in America, we have a defend in place laws, you know, where you can defend your ground. The big one is what happened in Florida a few years ago with Trayvon Martin and George, whatever George's last name was. You have that situation where, you know, there the whole defense for the one guy was he's defending in place. Well, I think a lot of that legal justification goes back to even this law right here where you have the right to defend in place. I know I'm working on a paper. Someone asked me about a year ago, maybe a couple years ago, is it right? Is it right to defend your property with force? Is it right? And so as I'm working through that, this is one of the key verses for me as I'm working through it. This is a key verse. It appears that at least if someone broke into your house at night, you have justification to defend. There's also the situation, I mentioned this a few weeks ago, with Nehemiah building the wall. When there was a threat against, what was a wall used for? A wall was used to defend and to protect not only the people in that city, but the property in that city. And remember, they're building the wall, and they stop building for a little bit because they're afraid, because there are threats made against them that, yeah, you build your wall, and we're going to come right through where you're building, and we're going to kill you and basically take your stuff. And Nehemiah's response to that after he seeks God is, okay, put a sword in one hand and a brick trowel in the other, and you defend yourself. If someone comes through that wall, what's the sword used for? It's not used to, you know, to bang him over the head. It's used to kill them. That's why you use the sword. So there's an indication there of even using force to protect yourself and your stuff. So there seems to be a biblical example or a biblical permission to defend stuff. But it's it's strictly defined. I think it's very strictly defined with regard to what the Old Testament law approved. Now, our laws, I think, are going through a bit of a metamorphosis with regard to this, and I think it's going to change as time goes, especially with the way that we litigate stuff now. You know, I took a class, a gun safety kind of class, a concealed carry kind of class, and it's actually scary. You know, it's scary. If you discharge your weapon and you injure someone, you're in big trouble. You're just in big trouble. If you kill them, you're okay, but if you injure them, you're in big trouble. It's kind of weird the way it works, what I found interesting here was the difference. So why? Why is it okay, not okay, why is it justified to kill the thief entering at night and not justified to kill the thief in your house in the daytime? Why is that? Let's go with Chris. He had his hand up first. Go, Chris. Good job. David?
I'd suggest a couple of potential reasons. During the day, your neighbors are likely to be awake, and you're likely to be able to get help very readily.
Yep.
At night, not so much. Also, during the day, this rule, if it were allowed to be a killing, would likely be abused. You just invite someone over and say, okay, you're dead.
Yep.
He was stealing something.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah, you got all three. You guys did a really good job. Those are the three reasons, I think. First is because you are not asleep. There is something to be said. When you're asleep and startled awake, you don't have the time to gather your wits about you and to ask 20 questions. And if it's dark, remember, they didn't have the kind of ambient light we have. There weren't street lights, right? There wasn't a microwave oven with a light on. You'd be surprised how much light a microwave oven puts out. If you're a night blind person and you're like I am, I can't see well at night at all if I don't have my contacts in. I walk into walls. You can ask Kathy. I walk into walls frequently. But if there's just even the microwave light in the kitchen, I can get around the kitchen just fine. It's amazing how much light that stuff produces. They had no microwaves. They didn't have a night light or a night lantern somewhere, you know, where they had burning they could see. They had none of that going on. So when it was dark for them. So they didn't have the opportunity to wake up, you know, and get a flashlight and walk around their house with a flashlight. They would have to light a torch, whatever they're doing. It's not easy for them to do that. So there was the idea of being startled awake. There's the idea of complete pitch dark and not knowing what the threat is. You have then justification to protect yourself, defend yourself against that threat. Okay, that's the nighttime. And that was what Chris said. What David said is also true. You have more capability of having or potential of having other people around you who are awake that can come help you. And so you were to call for help and have people come help you subdue the thief. It's interesting. You're not just supposed to let the thief get away. You know, that's also something that Chris noted. You're not supposed to let the thief get away. It's not like you say, oh, okay, well, take my stuff then. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to subdue the thief, and if you catch him, and then he's supposed to pay back, right? He's supposed to pay back, and if he can't pay back, then he goes to, he goes to, he's sold to pay the debt. So he's sold into slavery for that. That's the way he's treated. But he's not just let go. He's not just, okay, you're stealing in the daytime. Great. Love your brother. That's not what's going on at all. You still catch him. You still subdue him, apprehend him. And so in the daytime, there'll be others supposedly to help you. Plus, you can actually, like Chris said, you can actually see what the threat is. You can see what kind of weapons he has, what kind of person he is, and you can actually address the threat more accurately in the daytime than you could at night. And then the last thing is exactly what David said. Have your friend over. You don't like him very well. Have him pick up something in your house. Oh, you're stealing that. Boom, you're dead. That would, you know, that's a great way to justify a homicide. So for those reasons, I think that's why the law, the day-night law is there. Yep, Ron?
I think I could add a couple to that. One is that in those days, you didn't have many strangers around.
That's true.
If it's daylight, you can recognize them and deal with them later. Another thing is that if he was going to harm you in those days, he had to get up to you. And
right. Yeah, it's hard to shoot a rock very far unless you got your slingshot, and then I guess you can get a swinging house. So those are also two decent reasons. So there is a reason for the difference day and night in the law, and I think those explain why there's a different in the law day and night. As we move on, and so I do think that kind of speaks to our defend in place. Whoa, got a little dizzy there for a second, almost fell over. Stopped it. It's all a blood pressure issue. My blood pressure medicine, I must have taken too big of a piece this morning, so I'll be good. If you see me fall, you'll know. If you see me starting to dance around like I'm drunk, I'm not drinking. I'm dizzy. So pray for me right now because it's still spinning. And I don't want to throw up. Water won't help. Thank you, though. Okay, I'm good. I gotta sit down for a little bit. Sorry, guys. Whew, stop. So, okay, I'm back now. I'm good. Whew, it stopped. Good. All right. Where was I? Oh, we're still on restitution. So, you're scared to death, and so am I. Not really. Moving on, the next is that was stealing stuff, stealing property, stealing something from a neighbor. The next is causing damage to a neighbor's property. When you're responsible for the damage caused, and I think this is a lesson all of us should take for borrowing somebody else's stuff or causing something to happen to somebody else's stuff. The first idea is when you are if you're responsible for causing a fire that damages somebody else's property, you're responsible to pay for the damage you've done. It's kind of the first and original Smokey Bear idea. Only you can prevent forest fires. But if you cause damage because you started a fire, you make full restitution. That means you pay everything back. You pay everything back. And if you cause damage to the other person's crops, then you pay back with the best of your crop. You pay back with the best of your stuff. So that's when you're doing something to affect the other person's property. And then he goes on to talk about breaches of trust. Oh, thank you. I hope it helps. I'm sweating like a stuck hog right now. He goes on to talk about breaches of trust. And basically it's if the thief isn't found. So like if you are borrowing somebody's stuff, right? You have somebody's stuff that you're borrowing. And the stuff gets stolen and while you have it, then the thief, let me take a drink. The thief is not caught. The thief goes free and the stuff is gone. Then how do you know where the stuff is? How do you know it was really stolen? And so now there becomes an issue of, did you take it? Or did a thief really take it? So now it's your word against my word. It's a he said, she said kind of deal. The law is really specific with regard to who wins in that situation. It's the one who takes an oath. The one who takes an oath wins. So I really was trying to figure out, so what is this oath? What is it where you stand before and you say, I swear on a stack of 20 Bibles, I didn't take it. Well, not necessarily. It is where you take an oath of innocence. It's you swear, and it's interesting, you swear by the name of God. You swear by the name of God. You swear by God. You take an oath. And as you take the oath, you're saying, I swear by God in heaven, I did not take that. In our day, oaths aren't taken very seriously. I think in those days, oaths were taken seriously, because who was the real king of Israel? It was God. And he hasn't necessarily demonstrated it yet to these people, but he's going to demonstrate that he takes oaths very seriously, and when you violate an oath, he can kill you, and he will kill you. So there was seriousness to an oath. But if a person said, I swear before God that I did not take that, it was done. It was done unless the person could produce two or three witnesses that would say, no, we saw you take the stuff. We've seen you spending the money. We saw you eating the ox, that whatever. If that person could produce two or three witnesses, then he wins. There's an ancient a book. It's the Nuzi tablets. And there are actually, in those tablets, there are actually case law from early Israel. And it actually presents a situation like this where two guys were in dispute regarding the use of another person's property. And the guy who was being accused of the using other person's property said, no, I haven't done it. But the original property owner brought evidence and two witnesses. And so while the guy swore the oath, there were two problems then, because he swore the oath falsely, he was guilty of death, and before he died, he got to pay back twofold what he'd used. So it's interesting to read some of that early case law of regarding Israel and see how they applied this to life. And it's just, for me, it's really neat to actually get a copy of something that shows, you know, this law being applied to daily life and how case law worked. I'm not a lawyer, nor am I the son of a lawyer, but it's just neat for me to watch that. So that's what's going on with regard to property. And it's interesting that when you use someone else's property, there was in some sense a contract of trust that you were going to take care of the property the same way that the owner of the property would take care of the property, and so when you violated that, it was called a breach of trust. Every breach of trust was going to be treated this way. So there was an expectation you would take care of the stuff. Now, there are also limits to that. If you were to take it and it was injured or driven away without anybody seeing it, well there's no clue as to how it happened. So if you took an oath, you'd say, I didn't do it. I was not being negligent. I was taking care of the animal the best I could, and it's gone now, and I swear by God in heaven, I did not take it. I haven't misused it. You're free. If you have borrowed it, but the owner of that property comes to your house and is with you while something happens to the animal, you don't pay for it. If you rented the animal, like you didn't have an ox, so you rented your neighbor's ox. You paid him a fee to rent the ox, and the ox dies while you have it, you don't owe anything, because the rental fee was the price for the ox. So that's how specific the law gets in regard to those kinds of things. So that's that. Verse 14, if a man borrows anything of his neighbor's, and here I think is the final summary law, if a man borrows anything of his neighbor's and it is injured or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. So you're going to pay it back. You're going to make full restitution. And when the idea of full restitution is mentioned in the law, it doesn't mean you barely make it up. You always give as much or more than the price of the animal or the ox or the thing was that you took. You always make it better. Like when you harm somebody's field, you give of the best of your field back to him. When you harm someone's stuff, you don't find, if you kill your neighbor's ox, you don't go find a cheap, lame, ugly-looking ox and give, well, here you go. You don't do that. You give him a really good ox. You pay him back well, and you pay him back double, as a matter of fact. So the idea is you're not just making it even. You're actually making it better, to a sense. So you're making it better. So that's how so what is the effect of that? What is the effect of that? I think that's the thing to get to here. Not the actual letter of the law, but what is the effect of that? Well, if you have a neighbor and you two are in dispute and you recognize, you know what, I was irresponsible. I was negligent with your animal. Here, take the best animal I have and take two of them. Take two of them. Is there then, does he have something against me anymore? No. Is there a good relationship still between the two of us? Absolutely. Absolutely there's a good relationship between the two of us. It encourages then brotherly love. That's what this law does. It encourages a right relationship between brothers, between people. It's what it encourages. It doesn't, and if you take the law seriously and you recognize, if I am negligent and something happens to this animal, I got to pay back twice, what am I going to do? I'm probably going to take care of that. You know, you think about it. The next time you borrow someone's lawnmower, all right, you think, if I do anything to this negligently, I've got to give him two lawnmowers? I'm going to take care of the one lawnmower. Because the reason I'm borrowing it is probably because I don't have enough money to buy one for myself, and now I've got to buy two? That's just crazy. I'm going to take care of the one I've got for a while right now. So it encourages two things. First, it encourages taking care of the thing beforehand. Secondly, it encourages a right response or a neighborly response. If something does happen, we're still good because you've made it right. You've made it right, unless you take the innocence oath option. And if you take the innocence oath option and you aren't innocent, well, then you've got to deal with God. Then you got to deal with God. And, oh, yeah, he's the one who made the Red Sea collapse on the Egyptian. He's the one who has been walking with him. He's that pillar of cloud and pillar of fire that you're watching. That's who God is. It's not a flippant oath that you would take. It would be a terrible, fearful thing. And if you recall, when God says, and I don't think this is an accident, when God introduces the law in most cases, he says, you will fear God. Fear me, love me, do the commandments, keep the law. That's always the way it goes. But fear is first. Why is fear first? Because if you don't really fear God, you don't see him for who he is, what difference does it make if you keep the law? What difference does it make if you keep the law? Well, he's going to give them reasons to fear. He's going to give them reasons to fear. And I don't think that stopped New Testament. I don't think the fear of God stops New Testament. Well, no, God's a God of love, and he loves us, and he is the God of love. Ask Ananias and Sapphira if you ought to fear or not. Just check with them about that. And all they did, was I think, misuse an oath. I think they in some sense took an oath before God saying, we're giving everything, holding back something, and it didn't last long for them. They were killed instantly. So I think that the fear of God is something that should continue to move us as we respond and work with each other. So those are the laws concerning restitution that are listed there. Next group of laws are laws concerning social justice. These aren't laws that are neighbor to neighbor, like property kind of laws. These are laws when you violate a social order, or you violate something socially, then these are the requirements for that. Yeah, Dave.
Is there a
So I think you have to take the first part. We looked at those kind of a little bit of that last time, when with the murder and that kind of stuff, and you, then you have to take and you play those with each other. You look at those with each other. For instance, I made an allusion to that today. There is kind of an idea when you've harmed someone else's ox, right? When you cause an ox to fall into a pit, when you do that. And the ox dies, you're supposed to pay back the ransom, right? Or if your ox, here's the idea I'm talking about. If your ox gore someone and they die, remember you were guilty of blood, you're guilty of that. That's a God thing. When you're guilty of blood guilt, that's a God thing. And typically every time there's blood guilt, it's because you violated one of the big thou shalt not kills or something like that. And God then requires blood guilt. But remember, in that situation, there was the ability to pay a ransom. Remember that? We talked about ransom last week, which really starts the door open for the idea of someone ransoming someone else's life, someone being a ransom or paying a price for somebody else. Clearly, that's a picture of Jesus Christ being our ransom. That's clearly what that is, ransoming us from eternity in hell. That's clearly what's being pictured there. So you have to, I think you have to read, you can't take these laws and disassociate them from the other things that are there as well. So and I even said, if you pay back double, but you can also, in some sense, there's another law that supersedes that says you're going to be killed as well, like the thief law. There's judgment for that that goes beyond just paying back double. So I think in some of those cases, while it's not actually written here, it's when you're ransomed, then these are the results of after you're ransomed kind of deal. So it's not an easy thing to do, and I don't have time, frankly, to try to lay those out. I have a book that I'm kind of trying to read alongside while I'm studying, and it's a book on the book of Exodus, and it is twice as thick as this Bible. It's in my truck right now. It is a huge book. But what it does is it explains those laws, and it does kind of give a side-by-side running how they work with each other. So yeah, you've got to, I think short answer to your question is you have to take all of it and see how they all intertwine and work together, because there are how do you say that word? Extenuating circumstances that might mean two laws play into one here at this point. So, yeah. Good question. Any others? I realized I was talking a long time and didn't let anybody talk. So, any other statements? All right, let's talk about social justice then. Again, these are not necessarily laws that are person against property dispute, which is what's been really to the case so far. Even animals, remember, those are property. Those are farm implements. Those are how they accomplish work. Verse 16 though starts these laws concerning social justice, and the first is when someone seduces a virgin who's not betrothed to anybody, then he basically is saying, I got a new wife. That's what the case is. He's gonna take her as well and pay the bride price and take her as his wife. But if the father refuses, if the father says, no way, you're not going to marry my daughter, not going to happen, the guy still has to pay a bride price. But it's not considered a bride price. It's just an equal amount to a bride price. So he's still got to pay for her. Verse 18, you shall... And these are just kind of sprinkled together. It would be nice for me, the way I think, if there was some kind of a pattern here. I have not developed a pattern yet. I just don't see it yet. Because we're jumping from, seducing a virgin to killing a sorceress. It says, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. A lot of questions there. What is a sorceress? And why not a sorcerer? Is a sorcerer okay, but a sorceress not? Lots of questions I asked, and I don't know if I have all the answers yet. Here's part of my answer. What is sorcery? Sorcery is anything that is using magic or divining or that kind of an idea. Something that would sorcery would be something that replaces or seeks to imitate and mimic the power of God. That's the deal. That's what sorcery would be, kind of, if you understand sorcery. That's what sorcery is. Sorcery is anything that would seek to mimic or to replace the power of God. Something that is supernatural. When you're trying to do something supernatural in and of your own strength and claiming you're the one doing it, that's sorcery. One of the clear examples of this is in Samuel, the witch of Endor, or the sorceress of Endor. She claimed to be able to conjure up spirits from the dead and have people talk to spirits from the dead. I think she was conjuring up spirits, but they weren't spirits of people. They were demonic spirits until Samuel shows up. That's why she's scared to death when Samuel actually shows up, because she's never had a real person show up before. That's another story we'll read another day. That's an example of a sorceress. What should have happened to her? She should have been killed. She shouldn't have been alive in the city. So that's that's what sorcery is. Sorcery is that trying to claim that you have supernatural powers, doing magic kind of stuff. That's sorcery. Okay? And it's really clear. The word's really clear here. It is not a sorcerer. It is talking about a female sorceress. That's who's, and you will not allow her to live. What is the point here? Wouldn't any sorcerer be killed? Shouldn't anyone who's practicing sorcery be killed? I think yes. Yes. But what makes a sorceress that much worse? Well, because not only is she claiming to do the power of God, she's usurping the rightful way of authority. She's usurping authority even in the land. If you understand what the authority situation was supposed to be, it would be God and then Father, and unfortunately Mom doesn't have a whole lot of authority. Women didn't have a lot of authority in Israel, and so when a woman sorceress would claim to be acting as God, she is completely throwing off the God ordained order that He'd set out. And I think, because it's not clearly said here, but I think that's why she is dealt with as harshly as she is. She is not to be allowed to live. So now that has been extremely, greatly misused throughout history, you know, with the witch trials, the Salem witch trials. That's been something extremely misused with regard to how you figure out who a sorcerer is. There are ways to do that, but not the way they did it in Salem, not the way they did it there. So they're not supposed to be permitted to live. And then you have other things listed that are like I said, it just jumps all around. Next one is that whoever lies with an animal shall be killed. That's not just laying down and petting an animal. That's not just having an animal sleep in your bed. That's not what's being talked about there when it talks about lying with an animal. You fill in the blanks, but that gets you put to death. Whoever sacrifices any other god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. The Hebrew phraseology there is devoted to the ban. There's discussion in the reading. Is that mean that they are to be killed, or are they just to be kicked out? If you understand destruction, I think that's pretty much destroyed. I think that's killed. So any worshiping or sacrificing any other god is killed. You're not supposed to wrong a sojourner, someone who's traveling in your land, someone who's in your land. You're not supposed to harm them because that you were sojourners in Egypt, he says, as your example. You're not supposed to mistreat widows and fatherless. They're supposed to be taken care of. James actually pushes back to this and says, pure religion undefiled is to take care of widows and orphans. I think he draws that idea from this text, where fatherless and widows were supposed to be taken care of and not mistreated. It's interesting, the response is, if you mistreat widows and fatherless people, then I'm going to kill you, and your wives are going to be widows, and your children are going to be fatherless. So you're going to make those, your own wife and kids will become what you're mistreating. And he takes it very seriously. He says, my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword. So he takes that very, very, very seriously. The next verse 25 is regarding poor. If you lend money to the poor, you're not supposed to ask interest back. You're not supposed to have interest back. You're not like a moneylender to him. You're not exacting any kind of interest. Here's one. If you take a neighbor's cloak and pledge, you got to give it back to him before nightfall. You got to give it back to him before nightfall, because that's the only thing he has to keep himself warm. And you don't want to mistreat your neighbor by keeping his cloak. What does that mean? Well, don't ever take your neighbor's cloak as pledge. Take something else as a pledge. Take his cooking utensils, whatever, but don't take his cloak as a pledge, because you got to give it back. You got to give it back. It's verse 21. That is his only covering and is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? If he cries to me, I will be passionate. I will hear him, for I am compassionate. Verse 28. You don't revile God or curse the rule of your people. So just a whole bunch of just laws that talk about justice. You can read. I'm not going to just read them all for you. Verse 23, I think, is significant. And verse 23, chapter 23, verse 1 is significant. And significant for a reason, because how is the law supposed to work? It only works when there's honesty between the parties. It only works when there's honesty. And so he says in verse 23, verse 1, you shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit, siding with the many so as to prevent justice. This goes back to thou shalt not bear false witness. This is an expansion of that commandment of bearing false witness. And he gives reasons that you might want to bear false witness. Why would you maybe want to bear false witness? Well, if you're promised a bribe, if you're promised some of the goodies for bearing false witness, that's hard for me to say now, bearing false witness, that would be a reason then to throw yourself in with that. If there are so many on one side and only one little poor person on the other, you would throw yourself in with the many. Why would you want to throw yourself with the many? Peer pressure. What's going on there? It's like, come on, you be one of us. And the idea is you're not supposed to maliciously bear false witness against someone else. This is just a further explanation of that law back in thou shalt not bear false witness. And the reason it is so significant, the reason even we today still take perjury as really, really, really a big deal. It's interesting. There are a lot of crimes that have statutes of limitation. What is a statute of limitation? It's after a certain period of years, you can no longer be tried for that offense. It's you're clean, you're done. Of course, murder has no statute of limitations. But I do think I know there's one, for instance, if you remember the Dennis Hastert, who used to be the Speaker of the House, congressman from Illinois, when back in the 1960s, he was accused of inappropriate contact with some of his students. It never went anywhere, never had anything happen, and the statute of limitations ran out on that crime. They, however, asked him questions. They had a deposition, right? A deposition. And they asked him questions at deposition under oath. And he swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. They found out, like 4 years ago, that in that deposition he lied. He lied in the deposition and was found guilty of perjury. And he went to jail, not because, and I'm not making any statement on whether he was right or wrong, guilty or not guilty in the original cause. I'm not saying that. But because he lied, he went to prison for something he couldn't be tried for. That's how we honor not bearing false witness. That's how we do it. And so it's a big deal. And for them, it was especially a big deal because that was how their legal system about how life would work. It would only work if people were being honest and not bearing false witness. If they did not, then justice would be perverted. There would be no such thing as justice, no such thing as how God designed Israel to work through the law. It wouldn't happen because there would be all this false witness stuff. And that is the problem. That is the problem. As you get to the minor prophets, read Micah. Actually, let's read Habakkuk. Habakkuk, what does he say? How long will I cry for justice and you won't hear? What was happening in the latter days of the Israel, the northern nation, is they were perverting justice on a major scale. They were in Amos, it says, they were actually getting themselves rich on the bones of the poor. They were basically gnawing on the bones. Is the imagery is you're gnawing on the bones of the poor to get yourself rich, to make yourself rich. And they were doing it by filing false charges, making false claims, bearing false witness against the poor, and exacting everything they possibly could from them, because they had perverted justice. And one of the ways that justice is perverted is through the use of false witness. And that's why it's a really, really big deal. So it's past time now, so we're gonna stop here at chapter 23, verse 4. And we'll work our way through. We did move a little faster today, yay. So let me pray and then let you guys go. Lord, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the truth that's there. Help us again to see the amazing grace you show to us as we line ourselves up against these things and recognize we fail daily. Thank you for loving us even when we were unlovely. We ask to see your name. Amen. Thanks. You're dismissed.